Okay, welcome back. We only have about a week left, so I've been getting a few more queries about papers, which is good. If you have any questions or need any help with any of that, just let me know. A few people have actually turned them in already. Hard to believe, but that's a good thing. So if you have it early, that's fine too. I'd be happy to take it early. Now, last time we covered taxation of real estate transactions. Any questions on that material? A few people had some questions afterwards, so is there anything you'd like to review? Does all that make sense? When you go out and start acquiring all those pieces of property, you'll know the tax consequences of doing so, I hope. All right, good. So that's all set. One thing that we did talk about before and that has garnered a little bit of interest from several people in the class is the grantor trust issue. And I was doing some reading earlier today, and the president's proposed 2013 budget wants to include a grantor trust in your estate. Now, there's nothing in there that says how he's going to do this. But think about this for a second. I just want you to run this through. If we have a grantor trust and he includes it in the estate, do we have any problems? You think he can get away with that? When would something be included in your estate? When it's transferred. When do you transfer something to a grantor trust? When is property transferred?
Immediately.
When you set it up, right? When you set it up. So when you set it up, you're paying what? Gift tax on it. And now he wants to require an inclusion of grantor trust in the estate, which means you'd also have to pay an estate tax on it. Now, can there be a double tax on that? There's not supposed to be. In theory, there's not supposed to be. You're only supposed to pay tax when you transfer something, right? But this is an attempt to subject a transfer to double taxation. But what about the income tax issues? With the grantor trust rules, remember, why are the grantor trust rules there? To prevent potential abuse. So he wants the grantor trust rules in place so that he can do what? Income tax, the trust income every year to either the grantor or the beneficiary, depending on whether it's grantor or beneficiary defective. So he wants that. At the same time, he wants to be able to pull it back in the estate. What retained interest would there be in that case that would allow him to do that?
Crony's help.
No, not unless he changes. What will he have to do if he wants to bring the crummy powers back into the estate? Congress can do this, but how can they make it work? I just want to get you thinking about this, because this is what you'll have to do in practice when all these proposals come up. You'll need to understand how these ultimately impact what you're doing in planning and impact the clients. But we could bring it back in by doing what? What exempts the crummy power, or the crummy right of withdrawal, from an estate tax inclusion?
You're giving the beneficiary 30 days power of appointment over it.
Right, that fixes the gift tax issue. But from an estate tax standpoint, if I give you a crummy power, what do we call that?
Present.
It's a present interest because of the crummy power, that's right. So for gift taxes, it's a present interest. For estate taxes, what is it? Anybody remember? This is a good way to bring a lot of the stuff we've been talking about together. Power of appointment, right? It's a power of appointment. What kind of power of appointment is it? It's a general power of appointment. So if it's a general power of appointment, it usually would be included in the estate. So why is it not included in the estate?
Just,
It is included in the beneficiary's estate.
Well, it would be if you have a general power of appointment, unless what?
Unless it expires, the hanging.
Well, what does hanging power address? That's right. We're getting there. What does the hanging power address?
The time lapse issue is...
The lapsing rights,
yeah.
Which addresses what? That pay no attention rule. So we have that rule that says if the right to have a general power of appointment doesn't exceed 5,000 or 5% of the trust corpus, then we ignore it and we don't include it in the estate. So if he wanted to, what could he do? He could take away that lapsing right, which would include it in the estate, but if that happens, will he be able to collect gift tax on the transfer? Anybody know how that works? No. He wouldn't be able to collect gift tax on the transfer. So it's kind of interesting. I just thought it was an interesting proposal because here you have somebody just throwing something up against the wall and saying, we don't like this fact that all of these mean people are doing this stuff that we've been talking about in class and exempting themselves out of those future transfer taxes. But there's no approach as to how he's going to get that done, which is kind of interesting. So if Congress just passed something like that without fixing all the other statutory provisions they'd need to fix in order to get that done, we'd have a mess. We'd have a mess from a planning standpoint. There'd be all kinds of court battles about that. And then not only that, unless the fundamental rules in the system itself change, he's also going to have to forgo current revenue to collect future revenue. Is that what the government usually likes to do? They want to forgo the current revenue to collect future? No. They want you to pay up front. They want you to pay as soon as possible. That's why Roth IRAs came around. Roth IRAs didn't come around to benefit you. They came around to benefit the government. Right? Because it gave the government money today, even though they're not going to get money in the future. And what makes this kind of interesting, with the Roth IRAs at least, the economic analysis on that, has been that for every dollar you convert to a Roth, that costs the federal government in present value terms. So we're still talking on apples to apples basis. I convert a dollar, it costs the government $2.54 in future revenue on a present value basis for every dollar that's converted to a Roth IRA. Not a good trade-off, but that shows you that the government wants money now as opposed to wanting to defer the receipts to the future. So when you see some of these proposals coming out, we're starting to see a lot of talk now about the tax proposals. And you'll see a lot more debate on this going forward, but that was one of the proposals in the president's budget message. Another proposal, something that we had talked about already, dealt with GRATs, grantor retained annuity trusts. If you set up a GRAT, do we want a long-term GRAT or a short-term GRAT? We want a short-term GRAT, right? Because the shorter the term, the less mortality risk we have. If you die during the term of that trust, what happens? Comes back into the estate, subject to tax in the estate. So the proposal in the budget is to have a minimum 10-year term on GRATs. So if you have a minimum 10-year term on GRATs, what do we do as planners? How do we fix that? It's not going to shut down the technique, not by a long shot. I'm sorry?
Unit trust?
Well, you could use a unit trust, but that'll defeat the purpose itself, right? Because with the unit trust, you're sharing the growth between the income and the remainder beneficiaries. But if you're stuck with this rule, let's say this budget proposal passes, and you have to have a minimum 10-year GRAT, what could you do in your planning with clients to mitigate that?
Could you plan when you paid out higher early on than later? Was that the
okay, yeah,
100% max?
Right. You might be able to. Well, the maximum payout requirements apply to CRATs and CRUTs, not to GRATs, right? You can pay out whatever you want, and you can actually structure GRATs in different ways. You can have increasing payment GRATs, and they're all different. We went over the simple version in class, but there are many, many different options that you have in the structure of those. But think about this. You're stuck with that 10-year term. You have a client that's 70 years old. Are you going to want to do a GRAT? There you go. There you go. What we might want to do is combine the grat with an islet, right? Because if we have an islet to cover any estate tax inclusion that might occur if the person dies during the term of the trust, it costs us a little bit more to do this, but we'd pay the insurance premium in return for being able to shift all that future growth. So it'll still be a valuable technique, but it just means we have to add another component to the planning. Kind of an interesting issue there. So and there's the proposal, the budget proposal wants to keep the, well, not keep it, but have set the exemption level at $3.5 million, which is much better than having it go back to $1 million, certainly. So $3.5 million would be helpful, and it sets the maximum rate too at 45%, which is nice. It's better, much better than the 55% rate than that we would have if we don't have any changes. So that's just a quick rundown. But I thought, since those things applied a little bit to what we've been talking about, if you can start to see how those proposals are going to impact planning, this is what you're going to do in real life. This is how things work. Okay. Any other questions? No other questions. All right. If there are no questions, our next topic is going to be the asset protection piece. And this is going to integrate some of what we've already talked about, because a lot of the techniques we use have asset protection features attached to them. Now, if the exemption, let's say the estate tax exemption remains at $5 million, most people aren't going to have taxable estates. Very, very few people are going to have taxable estates. But from an estate planning standpoint, one of the things you need to consider is this asset protection component, because more and more people are concerned about having the asset base diminish through things like lawsuits and other attacks on that wealth. So for the smaller wealth, the lower net worth individuals will want to have the focus be asset protection. For the higher net worth individuals, we focus a little bit more on the value and transferring the value. A good friend of mine, Steve Lineberg, some of you may know that name, he speaks a lot at different industry conferences and so on, used to be a colleague of mine. He always used to refer to this as removing the wealth from the attacks of creditors and predators. So the creditors are the people that come in and try and either sue you, or you actually owe money to. If you owe money to people, of course, they're entitled to get that back. But what we're really concerned with, usually in the asset protection area, is not the people that you legitimately owe money to. It's the people that get a judgment against you because they scraped their thumb on your sidewalk and they got some jury to give them $50 million in damages for scraping their thumb because some jury didn't understand the value or the actual extent of the injuries. So that's the creditors. The predators, I love this, the IRS. The IRS is sort of a super creditor. They can do a lot of things that other people can't do. So by making sure that you do the tax planning in the process, you're exempting yourself from as many claims as you can from the IRS, which is a good thing to do. Okay, there are lots of things that this involves, and I'm going to go through some of these quickly. The estate, trust, gift tax law, of course, is incorporated because those are the highest tax systems in our tax structure. So we've got to make sure we minimize exposure to that. Business law is going to become important. We're going to talk about a few of the business applications here, and this will lead into a discussion on business succession planning that we'll also have. We'll talk about a little bit about things like buy-sell agreements, how to structure businesses to maximize family wealth transfer, and so on. So that's the business succession planning discussion. The family law, a few of you were interested in looking at things like premarital agreements. And family law is an important part in asset protection because it sets all kinds of rules for you without your consent. If you get married, for example, and you don't have a premarital agreement, what you've done is you have delegated to the state legislature the authority to determine the terms of your marriage and the dissolution of that marriage should it ever dissolve. So would you rather have the state legislature make those decisions, or would you rather make those decisions? You'd rather make the decisions, right? It's kind of like dying without a will. If you don't die with a will, what happens? The state legislature decides where all your property goes. If you don't get married without a prenup, the state legislature decides how everything's going to be split up. If you don't enter into an agreement with a business partner when you set up your business, state law determines what the terms of that agreement are. There are default provisions for contracts between owners of corporations and partnerships and so on. So family law becomes an important part of that process. Pension law isn't as important as the other pieces, and you already know that. If you have a qualified plan, we have perfect asset protection, right? At least until you hit 70 and a half. So if you could defer hitting 70 and a half, that's a good thing. You can avoid having a lot of those creditor issues. But if you're close to that age, then you're going to have some problems potentially. And then we have some other issues that come into play too. But from a client perspective, all we want to do really is that's what the castle is, what the client has, what they want to protect. We want to put the moat around it. That's the whole objective of the asset protection planning process, just to make sure that we protect it from claims of all of these people. The IRS, of course. Divorce, we already talked about that. The litigation, that's a bigger and bigger issue, although Texas has partially solved this. I don't know if all of you are aware of this, but beginning this year in Texas, if you sue in tort, which would be any kind of personal wrong, so you slip and fall on your neighbor's sidewalk and you sue, and then you don't win the suit, not only do you have to pay all your lawyer's fees, you have to pay all your opponent's lawyer fees, plus all the court costs. So Texas has moved to what we call the English system. This is how it works in England. The loser pays everything. And beginning this year, 2012, in Texas, that's how it works for tort law. So anybody that tries to sue you, now this should make sure a lot of suits never come up to begin with, right? Because a lot of people aren't going to want to take that risk of losing if they don't have a real claim. In the other systems, which the rest of the country follows, where each side pays their own attorney's fees, what the heck? If you can get some attorney to do it for free on a contingency basis, right? What's to stop you from going in and suing the heck out of someone just to see if you might win the lottery when you get to court? And you laugh, but that's a lot of lawsuits are set up on that basis. There may not be any real claim. It's just an opportunity that arises that somebody says, oh, well, what the heck, let's file suit, and then we'll send an extortion demand to the insurance company, see what we can get, settle the suit, and we wind up walking off with something. So in Texas, that's changed, which is a good thing. The last one, spendthrifts. Let me mention this for a few minutes. This relates to our discussion of various trust techniques that we've been using. One of the major problems with family wealth transfer is that eventually you're going to get some people in the family that aren't very good at managing that wealth and are a heck of a lot better at blowing it than actually accumulating it. And there's an old adage that people used to use in family business planning, when some of you may have heard this, it's boom to bust in three generations. You ever hear that? The first generation builds the business, the second generation maintains it, and the third generation blows it all. And then the fourth generation has to start again. And there's this kind of natural cycle that you go through. Well, that's what we're trying to protect against here. If we have people that are going to go out and blow that accumulated wealth, make it disappear, and not treat it appropriately, not do the things that they need to at least maintain, if not grow it further, then we've got to stop them in their tracks. We have to have a way of making sure they can't do that, because we want to preserve that wealth for people that can use it appropriately. So that's the spendthrift issue, and if we're successful, we get all those benefits. Now, how do you do this? The starting point's very easy, and we'll talk about insurance very quickly, but insurance is the starting point. We want to make sure that all of the good insurances are in place. Now, think about this from a financial planning standpoint. When you're doing financial planning, it's almost a three-step process, right? The very first thing we do is manage the risks. We make sure that we have all the appropriate insurance coverages in place, because if we start saving and investing right now before we manage those risks, what can happen? You can be wiped out. If you don't have homeowners insurance and the house burns down, doesn't matter if you were doing really well in your portfolio, you just lost a major asset. At least for most people, that's a major asset in their total net worth, is the house. So before we get to that savings and investing piece, we need to have all the risk management in place. Same thing here. We want to have the risk management in place to shift the appropriate risk coverages to other people, so we don't have to worry about that. Then we can use things like trusts and annuities. Trusts are probably the most flexible of the tools we can use because there are lots of different types of trusts we can use, different ways we can structure them, and so on. Annuity contracts do give us some asset protection. And sometimes people use this when they do things like Medicaid planning. And the reason they get asset protection is once you annuitize an annuity contract, what can a creditor get? They can only get the cash flow. They can't get at the underlying principal. So it mitigates the amount the creditor can get at, and sometimes that's enough to fend off some claims. So annuities can be used in that way. We can use business enterprises, and I'll talk more about this in a second. In fact, the family limited partnerships, limited liability companies, are good alternatives to premarital agreements. So if I have a kid that's just insistent that they're going to get married and they're not going to have a prenup, because they know more than I do, right? That's, some of you are shaking your heads. You may have experienced this with children. Children go through phases where they know more than the parents know. So if they're not going to do that, well, I can force it by using FLP and LLC structures, which I'll talk to you about in a few minutes. And then the premarital agreements are the best way. And then Medicaid planning. That's a big area in the asset protection area. When we start to talk about asset protection, lots of people talk about this Medicaid planning stuff. It should be, in my view, part of the insurance piece. Because the best way to do the Medicaid planning is to have a long-term care policy in place that'll cover those risks. That's a completely appropriate risk to shift, is the risk that you might have to go into a nursing home. So if you do that, you don't have to worry about all of that nonsense. And then not only that, there seems to be a common misconception out there about the long-term care insurance. A lot of people don't like to buy it because it's perceived to be expensive. Right? The premiums are expensive, particularly as you get older. They're somewhat expensive. Well, you shouldn't really look at the premium dollar amount. The premium dollar amount doesn't matter. What you should look at is that premium dollar amount relative to your entire portfolio. Because by paying that premium, you're protecting the entire portfolio. And in most cases, people are only paying a couple basis points on their portfolio to protect the entire portfolio. That's a pretty good trade-off. When you view it that way, when you're buying that protection for a couple of basis points a year, it makes perfect sense to shift that risk. That's not something you should be retaining. Second reason you probably want to shift the risk as opposed to retain it on the nursing home side is that if you retain the risk, what do you have to do from a planning standpoint? You have to keep enough assets to pay for your care or spend everything down, plan not to have any assets at all, so you go on Title 19, which is the Medicaid, which I wouldn't suggest any of you do. If any of you have seen the facilities that provide services to people that are on that program or see the type of lifestyle they live, this is not something you want to have happen to you. You don't want to have it happen to your family members either. So those essentially are two choices. You can keep enough to pay for it, so you have options, or you're leaving yourself to the whim of the state in funding your care, which is not going to be a good option. Now, if you keep too much yourself, what's the problem there? Okay, right. It's a lot cheaper to pay the premium, right, compared to the benefits. So you could. It's a lot cheaper to pay the premium. But think about it from a planning standpoint. Why don't I want to keep a lot of assets around? What happens to assets I keep? Subject to estate tax, right? Subject to estate tax, subject to claims of creditors, and so on. If I buy the long-term care insurance and I've hedged that risk, now I can transfer more of my assets, can't I? And by transferring more of my assets now as opposed to in the future, what I'm doing is I'm shifting all that future growth as well as reducing the size of the estate. So we're managing an estate tax liability at the same time we're getting future growth out of the estate. Does that make sense? See how all that works? So wealthier people, the old wives' tale is the people that have a net worth over X dollars don't need to worry about long-term care insurance because they can self-fund it. Absolutely wrong. The higher your net worth, the more you need the long-term care insurance, because we want to take your assets and we want to plan with them. We don't want to hold them so that we can pay that to a nursing home when you get sick. Hopefully you never have to go to a nursing home to begin with, but if you do, we want someone else to pay that, not you to pay that. So anyway, those are the items that we need to cover quickly. The insurance is pretty easy. The property coverage, you know, the homeowners, of course, you've got to make sure that that's up to date. I'm sure you've talked about that in your risk management courses. There was a couple of summers ago when I was here teaching a class, there was a house in Lubbock that had burned down. A gentleman had bought a house 30 years ago or something in Lubbock, 30 or 40 years ago, paid $6,000 or $8,000. I don't know what houses were going for back then, but it was a relatively small amount of money. House burned to the ground. He had never, ever changed his insurance. So he had insurance coverage on something like $6,000 or $8,000, whatever the value of the house was when he bought it 30 or 40 years ago. And the house burns down, and the insurance company agrees to pay out a percentage of the $6,000 or $8,000, even though he's been paying the premium all that time. You need to keep the coverage up to date. Everybody hates to do that, but that's a really important part of the financial planning process, because if you don't, clients can be at risk. If you do have other things like autos, boats, planes, all that kind of stuff, of course you want to have that in place. Medical, this has become a bigger issue now because of the Affordable Care Act beginning next year. Well, actually, it's beginning 2014. It doesn't really take effect until they can hit you with a penalty. But if you don't have medical insurance beginning in 2014, there's a penalty you have to pay, a tax penalty. And it's based on a percentage of your adjusted gross income or set at a minimum level. So you want to have the health coverage. That certainly should be something in place. The dental, maybe not, because you can self-insure that to a large extent. Dental procedures are not all that expensive. They might be a few thousand dollars here or there if you have sophisticated ones, but it's not going to be the equivalent of $250,000 open heart surgery if you need something like that. So that's probably not as important. And the long-term care I already mentioned. Now, on the income coverages, disability, business continuation, this gets to the business succession side of the house. And certainly for individuals as well, we have disability insurance. You want to make sure that you have your income covered, but you got to watch out for that, because sometimes the disability policies may not pay off when a client becomes disabled. Now, when would that happen? Well, I can give you a case in point. We had a client came to us after the fact. It was nothing we could do about it at that point, but came to us after the fact. He had a pretty good disability insurance policy, and he was disabled. He couldn't work. However, he also owned interests in S corporations that were passing through income to him. And the way the disability policy was written, because the S corp was passing through income to him, they classified that as earned income, and he was not entitled to receive distributions under the disability insurance policy. So you got to be careful with particularly clients that have income from multiple sources. If you have a client that has a job, that's easy. We can get the disability insurance policy to cover the gap, and we're all set there. But if you have a client that has a job and then they have a couple of business activities on the side, if you're going to buy the disability insurance, you want to make sure that you get insurance that's going to pay if they're still getting pass-through distributions from those types of entities. So that is something to be concerned about with those types of clients. So once you hit normal retirement age, of course, you don't need disability insurance anymore because you'd be entitled to retirement benefits. But some of your clients may have those policies, and they may not realize that if they're continuing to work that they need to drop them. So you might want to review that with them. The business continuation essentially is a disability policy for a business. So let's say I run a small law firm in my hometown, and I have a secretary, a couple paralegals, a receptionist, and maybe an associate, and I get sick. And I'm the person that generates all the revenue. I'm pretty much the reason all the money comes in. All the other people are support people. They help me manage the workflow that I'm able to generate. Well, I get sick, become, maybe I need some kind of treatment or something, I'm going to be out of work for a year, what's going to happen to the business? The money's not coming in. How do I pay all those people? How do I keep the office open? How do I do that? You can buy business continuation insurance for that purpose. Very good thing to do whenever you're dealing with small business owners. Larger business owners probably don't have to worry about this because usually there are multiple people that are managing things and bringing money in and so on. But this is really, really, really important for the smaller business owners, particularly when you have one person who's kind of the kingpin managing everything and bringing the money in. If they have to go out for medical treatments for 6 months and can't afford to pay the secretary and the paralegals and all those people or and the rent and the electricity, when they get off the treatments in 6 months, they don't have a job either. Not only have all those people lost their jobs, the business owners lost their job too. So that fixes that. Now liability, you all know about this too. And I know you talk about this in your fundamentals class. You want to have appropriate coverages on underlying policies like homeowners and auto. So the standard auto policy usually has something, it varies by state, but it could be as low as $50,000 of liability on the standard auto policy. Now, does anybody know how much it costs if you get sued? If you wind up in an accident, you wind up going to court? That $50,000 will be used up in attorney's fees before you even get to court. It's not going to cover you for any actual damages that might have to be paid later. So you want to make sure that those are probably a little higher. And then you can also get the umbrella policy. Now this is where things get a little tricky from an asset protection standpoint. Because umbrella policies are good and they should be used in coordination with your homeowners and auto. Usually you can't get the umbrella unless you maintain a certain liability level on those underlying policies. And then you can get the extra million to 10 million, whatever you want to get actually in that. But if you get too much, if you get too much liability protection, you actually become a target for lawsuits because you're a deep pocket. And the other side knows that just because they scrape their thumb, they can go and bring this suit and it won't even cost you anything because it's the big bad insurance company that's going to get stuck with the bill. So, and they're more likely to settle anyway because they don't want to go to court. So if you get too much on the umbrella policy, that could actually make you a target for lawsuits. So you don't want to necessarily do that. And some physicians do this in their planning now as well. They minimize the amount of liability protection they get on their medical malpractice and then make sure that their assets are structured in a way that they are not subject to judgment in a suit, and in a lot of cases those frivolous suits then go away because the people realize they can't get very much from suing. So it's a good way to be proactive in preventing the suits from coming in to begin with. Now professional liability, all of you should have that when you start practicing, and that's your errors and omissions coverage. Make sure you have that in place. It's usually pretty cheap too. It's not that expensive, but it gives you that protection from those lawsuits. Now the trust that you can use, we've talked about some of these, and we'll talk about the dynasty and the foreign trust in a little bit more detail later, but let me just cover a couple of these items quickly that we haven't seen before. Spendthrift trust. Spendthrift isn't really a type of trust, but anytime you set up an irrevocable trust, you want to have a clause in it called the spendthrift clause. And what the spendthrift clause says, very simply, is that nobody can anticipate receiving a distribution from that trust. Nobody can, not even the beneficiaries of the trust. So if the beneficiary can't anticipate receiving a distribution, a judge can't order a trust to make a distribution for that beneficiary. Now the best type of trust from an asset protection standpoint would be a purely discretionary trust, where the trustee has the right to distribute but doesn't have the obligation to distribute. So how would you like to be a beneficiary of a trust where there's all this money in the trust, but anytime you want money, you have to rely on me to make that decision? Right? This scares a lot of people. There are ways we can mitigate this, but that gives us the best asset protection because none of your creditors now can touch the assets in that trust. And if they can't touch it, even if you wind up running into creditor problems or you've been sued and there are problems with the asset base, the trustee can now buy assets for your use, can buy things directly for you, like food and pay for your pay for your housing costs and so on. They can pay that directly without you even owning the assets. So you still have all of that access. It's not as scary a thing as a lot of people first think when they think about that. So spendthrift and discretionary usually go together. The ideal trust would be one with a spendthrift clause that has purely discretionary distributions on behalf of the trustee. Support personal children's trust, those are just specific types of trust for given purposes. No big deal on those. And then the dynasty trust and the foreign trust. We've already covered dynasty trusts, at least the basics of them, and I'll add a dimension to that when we talk about the foreign trust issues in a second. Now, before we can get to any of the planning and asset protection, you first have to make sure that we don't have something called a fraudulent conveyance. And this is where the debtor-creditor law comes in. A lot of people forget about this, and this is really important for planners for one reason only. That is, if you help a client engage in one of these fraudulent conveyances, not only is the client criminally and civilly liable for that, you are criminally and civilly liable for helping them engage in that planning. So you can wind up going to jail, and you can wind up getting fined. So you've got to know how to protect yourself. That's the key in this area for financial planners. How do you protect yourself so you don't find yourself in that position? I don't want to see your name in the newspaper because something like this has happened. So anyway, there's the formal definition: a conveyance or transfer of property, the object of which is to defraud a creditor, hinder or delay him, or put the property beyond their reach. Now, this has a long history. This first came out in the Statute of Elizabeth back in 1571. That was when Queen Elizabeth I was on the throne in England, of course. They named the statutes after the monarchs in England. And you may think that, well, that's an arcane thing, but most states, almost all the states in the United States, still enforce the Statute of Elizabeth. It's part of the common law that we adopted when we seceded from England. Now, there are a few states that have what are called anti-Elizabeth statutes, and those are the states with the best creditor protection. So anyone want to take a guess at what states those are? No? No, Connecticut's horrible on this stuff, by the way.
North Dakota?
Is it Delaware?
Delaware, North Dakota,
yeah.
South Dakota, Alaska, and then there are a few others. They have anti-Elizabeth statutes in place to avoid this. Now, in the Statute of Elizabeth, if you did anything that resulted in depriving a creditor from being able to gain access to assets at all, you could be liable even if you didn't know you were insolvent at the time. So it's a much stricter rule. The more modern version, and a lot of states have tempered that Statute of Elizabeth with these Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act is the most modern version. I think just about all the states have now adopted that, but there might still be a few holdouts for the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyances Act. Those give us the state-based rules on how creditors can gain access to your assets. The bankruptcy laws are also important because when you get a discharge in bankruptcy, you can only get a bankruptcy discharge is an equitable remedy. And in the old days, even in the United States, in the old days, there used to be two court systems. There was a law court and there was an equity court. Now they've been merged in every state except Delaware. Delaware still has a separate chancery court, an equity court. But every other state's merged them. But bankruptcy is an equitable remedy, which means you can't get a discharge in bankruptcy if you come to the court with unclean hands. If you come after having committed a bunch of dirty deeds and you want to be wiped clean, they're not going to let you do that. They're not going to give you the discharge. So bankruptcy law can be important. Now, fraudulent conveyances can result from all of these things. I just want to highlight a few of these that relate to planning. First of all, inaction. If I don't do anything, that's enough to be a fraudulent conveyance. Now, how could this work? Well, let's say that I have a power of attorney for my parents. And that power of attorney confers a general power of appointment on me over their assets. Now, the power of attorney expires when they die. I get in creditor trouble, and I don't exercise that power of appointment